Support for this public radio podcast comes from the Society for Human Resource Management, which also sponsors PBS's CEO Exchange, online at shrm.org. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, recognizing the value of financial advice since 1937. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The stimulus package is halfway home. The House passed it overwhelmingly this afternoon. Senate leaders are promising a vote by the end of the week. What might not be entirely clear, though, is whether the economy needs stimulating at all. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Constellation Energy, working to provide responsible, sustainable energy to power America's future. Constellation Energy, the way energy works. And by Shriners Hospitals for Children, providing treatment for orthopedic, burn, and spinal cord injuries at no cost to the families. More at ShrinersForKids.org.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you here on this Tuesday. Today is the 29th of January. You can get experts on either side of the argument to weigh in on whether we're in a recession yet or not. But what we do seem to have here is an economy that can't quite make up its own mind, or more accurately, consumers who can't decide. The Commerce Department reported an especially un-recession-like number today. Orders for durable goods, that's expensive stuff like refrigerators and computers, they jumped more than 5% last month. At the same time, though, we learned consumer confidence tumbled in January. Maybe we're buying more stuff to make ourselves feel better, but if you frame all of that against the backdrop of tomorrow's interest rate announcement from the Federal Reserve, it only raises more questions about which way the economy is going. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon is here to answer those questions. Hi, Bob.
Hey, Kai.
Seems to me what we have here is a situation where it's not a matter of if the Fed cuts, but how much. My question to you then is, how much does the Fed push on interest rates, or pull, I suppose, since they're going to cut, in the wake of today's economic news?
Well, if we can use that metaphor, you want to get the economy back in the saddle without pushing all of us all the way over to the other side of the horse here. The betting on the futures markets right now is that the Fed is going to cut its benchmark rate by half a percentage point, down to 3%. Now, that's a very interesting number because it just so happens that the Commerce Department tomorrow is releasing the inflation figure for the last quarter of the year. And if you factor out volatile food and energy costs, the consensus among leading economists is that it was probably running around 2.5%. So we've got the prospect here of the cost of borrowing money maybe even being cheaper than the core inflation rate. And some economists say this is very risky business now. Will that just trigger another round of borrowing and spending again? And if you're lucky, you might spur the economy, but you also might fuel inflation.
And of course, you have to guess that the chairman of the Fed has already seen that inflation number or has a good idea what it's going to be. The question becomes, why would he take the risk of inflation?
It's very tricky. These monetary policymakers are looking at an economic threat on several fronts right now. You've got real estate values declining. You've got stock values declining. You've also got the prospect that the labor market is softening up, and there's a real chance that real incomes could start declining. The last time all three of those planets aligned was 1974, which happens to have been a recession year. And you had the double whammy of inflation then, or stagflation, if you will. And there are signs of that every day. I don't know if you saw just yesterday, Hershey is going to be raising the wholesale price of its candy bars by as much as 13%. It's the second price increase by Hershey in a year. That sort of thing, that sort of news we're seeing every day.
What happens, do you suppose, in the markets and in the wider economy if the Fed does not come through with that rate cut tomorrow?
Well, Mr. Bernanke must be very mindful of warnings from a lot of stock market analysts out there that the market could tank again if there's no rate cut at all. That would just compound the economic slump. There are also some economists who say the big 0.75% rate cut that we saw last week really smacked of panic, and they say it might even be inflationary, so the Fed might just stop now, not do anything. Some say, well, split the difference. Maybe a quarter percentage point might be the trick here.
Oh, to be inside the mind of the Fed. Marketplace's Bob Moon. Thank you, Bob.
Thanks, Guy.
A Fed of a different kind, the Federal Bureau of Investigation, might be getting involved in the root cause of the economy's troubles. There are reports this afternoon federal investigators are looking into 14 companies involved in subprime lending. Accounting fraud and insider trading are being mentioned as possible charges. That's about all the detail there is on that so far. Two prominent state-run experiments with universal health care have run into trouble. The Massachusetts plan that went into effect last year is $400 million over budget. And yesterday, the California Senate rejected Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger's plan to insure nearly everybody who lives out here. Still, though, some presidential candidates say they can get coverage for all. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer has more.
I want to get to universal health care for every single American.
Mandatory health insurance is a central part of Hillary Clinton's message. Her proposal is similar to the Massachusetts plan, now spattered with red ink. Barack Obama would only mandate insurance for children. John Edwards backs mandates. His health care advisor, Peter Harbage, says the Massachusetts plan is just having growing pains.
There's no such thing as universal, voluntary anything.
Harbage says Massachusetts and California are having problems with universal coverage because they have to guess how much health care money the feds will give them. UCLA School of Public Health professor Richard Brown says the federal government doesn't have to guess.
But clearly the federal government has more resources, dollars that can be put into direct subsidies for health insurance expansion, and also tax credits.
Republican candidates support tax credits for health insurance. Mitt Romney has backed away from the mandates he embraced as Massachusetts governor. Democrats who favor them still have to explain where all the money will come from. Duke University health policy analyst Chris Conover.
The typical response is, oh, well, we can pay for it by, you know, repealing the Bush tax cuts. And so I think the average American thinks, oh, cool, those rich folks are going to pay for it.
Conover says that's not realistic. Either way, health care is a top issue for voters and the candidates. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
The trader who cost the second largest bank in France more than $7 billion said today the higher-ups at Société Générale must have known what he was doing. The bank's lawyers fired back by calling Jérôme Crevel a liar and a cheat. French prosecutors on the case say he's a trading addict. Stacey Vanek Smith reports the bank might have saved itself some money if they'd just given the guy a vacation.
Ted Weisberg is president of Seaport Securities. He's been working on the floor of the New York Stock Exchange for nearly 40 years, and he's never taken more than 5 days off at a time.
I think the thing that has kept me close to the trading arena of my entire life is fear of missing that one great trade.
Weisberg says most of the traders he knows are just like him.
I don't want to say that they're addicted, but they are certainly drawn to it. It is, at the end of the day, very, very exciting.
Sometimes too exciting. Jérôme Crevel hacked into computers, stole login codes, and made billions of dollars worth of fraudulent trades. French prosecutors describe him as a trading addict. That kind of addiction is part of the reason many banks encourage traders to take 2 consecutive weeks of vacation. Kevin Ferry with Cronus Futures Management says that time is also supposed to help banks detect fraud.
If they made you go for at least 2 weeks at the same time, they'd be able to tell if you were allegedly doing something unkosher.
In fact, Jérôme Crevel only took 4 days off last year, and that's in France, where most people take at least 6 weeks. If he had taken a couple of weeks vacation, audits might have exposed his multi-billion-dollar fraud. Or not. John Coffey directs the Center for Corporate Governance at Columbia Law School. He says forcing traders into Caribbean-bound planes is no failsafe against fraud.
You find out one particular technique, you put in new controls to stop that, and someone invents a new strategy.
Coffey says it's not addiction or vacation banks need to worry about. It's watching the shop, plain and simple. I'm Stacey Vanek Smith for Marketplace.
It was comme ci, comme ça on Wall Street today as investors wait to see what the Fed's going to do à demain. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. By the time all the speeches are over tonight and the analysis is said and done, Florida is going to be firmly in the political rearview mirror. Next Tuesday, voters in 24 states will weigh in on the presidential field, or what's left of it. The choices are getting narrower almost by the week, even though we're still 10 months from Election Day. Commentator Jeffrey Anderson says there's nothing wrong with early primaries, as long as the right states go first.
Critics of the primary calendar complain that early states don't represent the country as a whole. New Hampshire is too white, South Carolina too black, Nevada's too seedy, and Michigan's just depressed. I believe early primaries are a good thing. An extended process encourages greater deliberation by voters. We watch candidates campaign from state to state and week to week. We learn who they are. This helps us make better decisions. But there's a problem with the current calendar, and it's not about racial diversity. The early primary states lack economic diversity. Farmers dominate Iowa's economy. Automakers own Michigan. So it's no surprise Iowans want more farm subsidies. Michigan and South Carolina demand trade protections. Politicians can pander to one set of voters without alienating another. Somebody does have to go first, but it shouldn't be a state that can be bought so cheaply. We need a state above retail politics, a state with an economy as diverse as America's. We need California to go first. California has twice Iowa's agricultural output. Its manufacturing sector is larger than Michigan and South Carolina combined. California also profits from the import industry. Billions of dollars in goods pass through its ports each week. Silicon Valley sets the standards in high tech. Hollywood leads in entertainment. Disneyland practically embodies tourism. Immigrants, a quarter of the population, compete for low-wage service sector jobs and high-end professional work. California is a major producer of both oil and alternative energy. The California economy is so vast, so productive, and so diverse that no politician can promise something for everyone. California is panderproof. In 2012, let's start the primary season in California. That would bring the full range of economic issues into an honest discussion. Trade deficits, transportation infrastructure, oil dependence, intellectual property rights, immigrant labor. I'd prefer to hear that conversation rather than listen again to what a few marginal states believe they deserve at America's expense.
Jeffrey Anderson is an editor at Slate. No surprise here at all, he lives in Los Angeles and Oakland, California. If you're being sufficiently pandered to this election season, or if you'd like some more, just let us know. Go to marketplace.org and click on Election 2008. The International Monetary Fund announced its best guess for 2008 economic growth today. It isn't exactly breaking news to tell you worldwide GDP is going to be a little bit slower this year, down 0.3% to 4.1% overall. The IMF says nobody's going to dodge at least some fallout from the U.S. subprime meltdown. It's one more indicator of how truly global the economy really is. Another indicator might be your blue jeans. Rachel Louise Snyder tells the story of a pair of pants in the global marketplace in her new book, Fugitive Denim. Rachel, nice to have you with us.
Thank you. Hi, Kai.
So listen, bear with me for a second, would you?
Sure.
All right. If I take my jeans off right now and look at the label inside, I'm not actually wearing jeans, but if I were, it would only really have one country as the made in label, right?
Probably. I mean, I have to say, I'm so tempted to ask you if you're, you know, you are wearing pants, right?
I am actually wearing pants. The beauty of radio. But just for the sake of it, if it was jeans, only one name in that label. What's the real story behind that?
Well, really, it's not representative of the number of countries involved. You'll have the cotton grown in a place like Uzbekistan or Azerbaijan. And in my book, it's Azerbaijan. And maybe Turkey. And then that's woven, all the cotton from those countries is woven for consistency into one large roll of fabric. And then it's dyed in a different country like Italy and then sent maybe to India where it might be cut and then sent somewhere else. But you might have six or eight different countries involved in that process because of the way trade rules are set up.
How do we then, you know, as American consumers who want the cheapest prices but the best quality products, I mean, is there a way for us when we go to the store and finger through all these jeans? I mean, we can't possibly know all this.
No, that's the real disappointing thing is that we've now come up with these standards for food where it has to say where our food is processed and where it's grown, but we don't have those same standards for clothes, and I think we need to. There is some industry movement toward a more accurate representation, but as of yet, no law.
We are now so conscious in this country of the pesticides on our foods and where they come from and organic everything. You couldn't, if you tried, do that with your clothes? Because, first of all, they are so chemically involved, but also it's so obscured by the route that they take through the global economy.
That's true. That's true. It's been said that there are 0.75 pounds of chemicals used in the production and manufacture of our genes. A lot of those chemicals are washed off by the time they get to our shelves, but they do have to go somewhere. I think the environmental consequences are far graver.
Is there a moment in time that stands out for you in the lifespan of this book? Not that is to say of the 2.5 years you spent writing it, but a moment in time of the life cycle of this product.
One of them, I would have to say, was just sitting out in the countryside in Cambodia with this garment worker after I'd known her for about 2 years, and connecting all that she did in the factory to all that she was able to give to her family. You know, they had a big house, they had all these cows, they had a fish pond, they had a vegetable garden, all kinds of things that they never had.
All because of a pair of blue jeans.
Yeah.
When you really sit down and think about it, do you think they are happy and pleased with their role in the life cycle of the pair of jeans that I have on right now?
I would say that they are more satisfied professionally, but I would say that lives are more complicated than just simply profession. And so there's things like with the Cambodian women, you know, they still live in a misogynistic, patriarchal society. So they still have to contend with the fact that they're expected to go off and put their brothers through school, but they themselves may never have a chance at education. So in that way, they're unhappy. But I think they're happy to be earning money.
You've heard Rachel Louise Snyder on the program before. She's got a new book out. It's called Fugitive Denim, a moving story of people and pants in the borderless world of global trade. Rachel, thanks a lot for your time.
Thank you, Kai.
Coming up, flooding is a new fact of life for Dutch farmers.
He's living here for 30 years now. He sees that the rains are more intensive than in the past. So the rising of the river is faster and higher.
But first, let's do the numbers. Stocks pulled higher again today on Wall Street as the Federal Reserve met to consider another interest rate cut. The Dow Industrials rose 0.75%. 96 points closed at 12,480, the blue chips did. The Nasdaq nudged up 0.33%, 8 points to end at 2358. The S&P 500 hiked up 0.6%, 8 points to finish the day at 1362. Financial companies grabbed the limelight today. American Express reported lower earnings, but ended the day up 0.8%. Countrywide also reported a sharp loss, but it traded up 6%. That after Bank of America said it won't back away from buying the troubled mortgage lender. B of A stock added 1.8%. After the bell, Yahoo reported a 23% drop in quarterly profit. Investors knew it was coming, but still they bid the stock up 0.1% before the bell. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Vanguard, offering investments designed to help individuals, institutions, and advisors reach their long-term financial goals. 888-VANGUARD. And by Angie's List, providing first-hand homeowner reviews on local contractors like plumbers, painters, and movers. Details at angieslist.com. Marketplace Entrepreneurship Reporting is supported by Lenovo, official computer partner of the Olympic Games. Lenovo dedicates 1% of income to support entrepreneurship and social ventures worldwide. Marketplace aims to be insightful and provocative. And if you send our stories along, you can be too. Log on to our website and forward any story you hear. Every day's rundown is there, along with transcripts of the show and links to individual pieces. It's at marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Wednesday. In Washington, the Commerce Department releases the fourth quarter gross domestic product report. The Senate Finance Committee holds a hearing on the economic stimulus proposal. And for creative types who dig the cold weather, the U.S. National Snow Sculpting Competition gets underway in Lake Geneva, Wisconsin. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Whether we're able to put the brakes on global warming in time or not, it might be a good idea to start thinking about what if, to have a worst-case scenario, a plan B. Some of the most vulnerable places in the world already do, and the Netherlands is one of them. 60% of the Dutch population lives below sea level. Dikes and pumps let them do that. But global warming is making it harder to keep up. Today, in our series Plan B, about how we're adapting to global warming, Rico Galliano explains how a new kind of defense is changing the Dutch landscape and the way some farmers do business.
Anno Drenen is a disaster official in the Dutch province of Brabant. He was on the job in 1995 when torrential rain nearly caused two rivers in Holland to flood.
Some 100,000 people were evacuated. Also, farms were evacuated, so we also had to deal with tens of thousands of cows. Not pigs, happily, because that would have been another sort of disaster, but yes.
Dutch folk tunes brim with these kind of tales. Water wreaked havoc on the Netherlands since the first settlers arrived. But for the last decade, the Dutch have had to endure unusual tidal surges in the North Sea, freak rainfalls swelling their rivers. In their folk tunes, the Dutch usually triumph over water. But climate change may be turning the tide. Pierre Wellinga is a climate change professor at Wageningen University. He says protecting Dutch towns by building dikes higher and pumping out more water is getting expensive, and it probably won't be enough.
Workers working in Rotterdam have their houses 5 meters below sea level, and pumping it out puts on your household bill maybe €100 a year. But then, if climate changes, it starts to cost, say, like €500 a year.
So the Dutch government has adopted what it hopes in the long run is a more sustainable plan. It's called Room for the River, and it boils down to this. To keep rivers from swamping towns, they'll create other areas where rivers can safely overflow. And this is the first one, over Diepse. 1,400 flat acres of green grass and dairy goats. Decades ago, it was covered in water. Then the Dutch built two dikes and pumped out the water between them. Presto, a dry valley surrounded by a river. They call this a polder. Today, Overdiepse Polder is home to 16 dairy farmers.
Hello.
Schach Broekmans is one of them. His neighbor, Stan Vlierekkers, translates.
He's living here for 30 years now. He sees that the rains are more intensive than in the past. So the rising of the river is faster and higher.
But the government's not going to protect these farms. It plans to demolish them and use the polder as a floodplain. Broekman says it's a sacrifice to help the big low-lying cities downstream.
We put this polder into work to give them their dry feet.
So you're allowing your polder to be flooded so the people downstream can keep dry.
Because they were so stupid to build so low.
And voor wat hoort wat.
Because we give the polder, we want to get something back.
What they want is to keep farming in Overdiepse. The Netherlands is tiny, after all. Farmland's hard to come by. But how can you stay and work on land that's occasionally going to turn into a lake? The farmers proposed a new plan, or actually a really old plan.
In the past, people who were living here in Holland, they were very smart. They only built their houses where the sea level would never come.
He's talking about terps, man-made hills some Dutchmen lived on in the Middle Ages. Their livestock grazed below. During floods, the animals just moved up to the terps too. Broekmans and his neighbors proposed this. Instead of paying them to move out of the polder, the government should build them new farms in the polder, on terps. The government agreed. But won't the plan leave farmers stranded when there's a flood? I asked Annemarie Moens, a provincial vice governor involved with the project.
The farmer can always go away, evacuated, of course, because that's very important. And then, well, we expected that the waters will stay there for a day or three or something.
The terps will be 20 feet tall, 6 acres wide, made of soil from a local quarry, plus dredged sand piped in from the North Sea. The project also involves strengthening one of the polder's dikes and lowering another. It won't come dirt cheap, but it's a drop in the bucket compared to Room for the River's $3.2 billion budget.
This project will cost like 100 million euros, but Overdiepse Polder is the first project to be executed, and that makes it very special because, well, everyone is watching, of course.
And not just Dutchmen are watching. With 80% of the world's population living near water, climate change professor Pierre Wellinga says terp technology could become a valuable export.
Building mounds for people to flee to during high water, it's a relatively simple technology. We believe it will spread around and our investment in knowledge and engineering will pay back.
Which could have some Dutch businessmen once again singing in the rain. In Noord-Brabant, the Netherlands, I'm Rico Galliano for Marketplace.
You can hear all the stories in our series Plan B online. Our website is marketplace.org. Plan B is a co-production with the Center for Investigative Reporting. Professional sports is a cutthroat business. We all know that. And it's not surprising with all the money that's on the line. So it's not unusual for one team to poach top talent from a rival. What you don't see every day is an owner trying to recruit a rival fan. Marketplace's Jeff Tyler explains.
Dallas Mavericks owner Mark Cuban was impressed recently when he came to a Los Angeles Clippers game. Not by what happened on the court, but by one particularly booming voice in the stands. Steve Perrin blogs about the Clippers. He says the fan known as Clipper Darryl is a constant presence. Clipper Darryl mobilizes fans with his boisterous cheers.
My kids love him. Every time we go there, they hear his voice and then they have to try and find him in the crowd. He's easy to spot because he wears a half-red, half-blue satin suit with a Clippers logo on the back.
Cuban approached Clipper Darryl, a.k.a. Darryl Bailey, and offered him a job, move to Dallas, and become the Mavericks' number one fan. Perrin says his first reaction to the news was,
huh? You don't pay people to be fans. You don't take a Clipper fan and say, now you're a Maverick fan. It doesn't really translate.
Economist Alan Sanderson at the University of Chicago follows the business of sports. His advice?
I'd sign the guy to a one-year or very short-term contract, or advise the guy, if you're going to move to Dallas, rent, don't buy, because I suspect the novelty effect could wear off fairly soon.
Sanderson says all sports teams are getting creative about filling the seats.
Is it the swimming pool in Phoenix out in the center field? Is it interactive seats? Could we have people get married before the game? Jerry Reinsdorf tried that here with the Sox.
Steve Perrin says he wouldn't begrudge Clipper Darryl for cashing in. In fact, he says if Mark Cuban has an extra $1 million, Perrin could be persuaded to blog about the Mavericks. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a 529 plan can help meet your college savings goals. Details at putnam.com. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note before we let you go. Today, the Pabst Brewing Company is trying to rehabilitate one of its dilapidated brands. Sales of Colt 45 malt liquor hit 2 million barrels a year back in the 1980s. It's down to less than half of that now after complaints that sales were targeted at the poor and minorities. So Pabst is trying to tap into a new market with hip slogans and a web campaign, and by putting all the art for its cheap beer on what looked to be brown paper bags. Who knows? Might work every time. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media on this Tuesday before the Fed meets. Today, the Dow gained 96 points, 0.75%. The NASDAQ rose 8 points, 0.33%. The S&P 500 added 0.6% there. Thanks to Renita Jablonski and Miguel Macias on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by John Buckley. Tomorrow on this program, ideas to stop global warming cold that could leave some of us in the cold.
Well, our model suggests that this could help. It also has the potential to really screw things up profoundly.
Oh. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.